So the Black Lotus one was actually a physical card, so I'll come back to that in a minute.
Listen up, Umi. This is a podcast with the most ducker. This is Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul, your host. I'm joined up by Adam Camilleri.
Even though.
And Tanya Gates.
Hi, everybody.
Hello. We are the Bell Lost Souls podcast. After last week's heavy episode, we're going to take a break for a week and have a bit of a palate cleanser. We're going to talk a little bit about lore this week. We're going to talk a little bit about a hobby segment. And in the middle of this episode, I have a segment from me and Pleasant Kenobi doing a spot, kind of talking about the bridge between competitive Magic and Warhammer 40,000 and getting, you know, jumping into the hobby with both feet. It's an interesting talk, and I hope you all stick around for it. And then after that, we'll come back with a hobby segment.
Yeah, it should be a good show. Happy in how the last one went down, but yeah, you're right. It was a pretty, by our standards, it was pretty dense, pretty heavy. And we're really, I don't know, it feels like Red. It feels wrong that Red wasn't here for it. I think that's what we're waiting for. We're
just hopefully. Work is keeping him from jumping in with us, and he'll hopefully be back next week. And I'd like to talk about, like, taking a stand on certain things. Now, not, I don't want to necessarily overly advocate what that stand should be, but when you take a stand, what the potential impact of that will be, and maybe, you know, you can make some better choices or more informed choices about what your stand should be after we've had that discussion.
Beautiful. Love it. Yeah, always love helping people make as informed choices as possible. So I am neck deep in the Horus Heresy at the moment, and I had a fluff question or a fluff topic I wanted to discuss, but mostly with these two lovely people. I've been mulling over this question we got given, me and Paul are on another show called the Thursday Show. If you haven't checked out that amazing program, please do so. We got given a rapid fire question. It just simply stated, did the Emperor plan it all? And I've been like mulling this question over like ad nauseum, trying to come to a conclusion in my head, because that's just how my brain works. It needs to come to some form of conclusion. But is that something you guys have ever discussed or wondered or pondered?
I don't know that I have in that context before. Like, because there's certain, you know, being in, you know, having this live in my head for as long as I have, I'm not exactly sure when all my opinions gelled up.
That's a thing though, isn't it? Because, well, there's has been a lot of iterations of the lore, and when you and I probably started, and you even before me, Paul, started playing, the lore was at a much smaller scale. Like the Horus Heresy didn't even exist as a novel form. It was only really in like little blurbs in the bottom right hand corner of codexes,
a couple of paragraphs in these amazing tomes, by the way, which the Black Library or Forge World. So, Games Workshop has reproduced to those two just epic tomes, The Slaves of Darkness and The Lost and the Damned. They are so flavorful. They got just this texture to them that just draws you in with the pictures and the lore. But yeah, Horus Heresy was like two pages worth of stuff.
Yeah, so it wasn't really something I conceived when I first started playing. Literally, when I started playing, like Armageddon, the Third War of Armageddon was like the world to me. That was the only piece of fluff that needed to exist for my enjoyment. And I engrossed myself with that. But now I'm starting to do that with the Horus Heresy and to a lesser extent the Siege of Terra. I'm listening to Solar War, first book in the Siege of Terra series. And so I'm starting to mull this over. And I've come to a couple of conclusions. I think the Emperor did plan it all. So to some extent, I think there was always going to be kind of an infight between Space Marine legions, as in there was some kind of inbuilt redundancy into that, into their construction, into their something, because otherwise, how do you explain how easy they were to turn against the Emperor? Like, it was legitimately kind of easy when you put it all together. All it took was Lorgar landing on a world and the influence of like Erebus and Corpheron, and bang, heresy. It happened.
I think that's a bit of a simplification.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But if you want to see where the pebble was that turned into the avalanche, that was it, wasn't it? That was the seed.
I mean, okay, so I just finished reading The First Heretic, and they kind of just covered this. Now, whether or not you want to, I don't mean no spoilers, but like whether or not you want to take the word of like a chaos spawn, not a chaos spawn, like a demon.
It's about a half demon.
Yeah. thing. But it seemed like the Primarchs were all sort of born out of a sort of magical mix of science and chaos through some sort of like agreement between the Emperor and the forces of chaos. So, I mean, it, at a certain point, like, isn't that kind of bred into their genetic code to be somewhat
susceptible?
Right?
Yeah, that was my assumption as well. I was like, at some level, I think the Emperor wanted a contingency and built in that the Space Marines, because literally what happened. Like, they got the Crusade event, like, didn't peter out, but kind of met its objective, and then they turned on each other. It's almost like that was how it was always going to be, you know? How could it be that simple?
But now what didn't reach a natural conclusion.
Not quite. It met its goal of kind of consolidating the vast majority of the galaxy, and the rest of it could have, like, with the fall of Ulanor, and then the Emperor essentially said, well, this is mostly done.
Yep.
I'm going to wash my hands, take a back step. And then Horus continued. And the galaxy was, to all intents and purposes, like, dominated, overwhelmingly dominated by the Imperium, yeah? There was no other galactic empires in contention. They knocked out the last one being the Orcs.
The Eldari had, you know, gone into decline. Necrons didn't exist. You know, well, they didn't exist as
in strength, yeah.
They were not awake at the time, I don't think.
Nids hadn't rocked up. The Tau was still a concept. Yeah. And so, to all intents and purposes, the galaxy was the Imperium's. You know, they were the only big power player left. I mean, of course, there was, like, you know, super arachnids and all those things.
Yeah, the heresy kind of touches on some other minor things or some non-compliant worlds.
Yeah. And then, you know, there was always, because Rangdon had already happened, and that we could do a whole episode on Rangda and the little bits that they're letting us know about that. But that was another huge galactic empire that, you know, that was xenocided. That was that species was wiped out. Because they needed to. The same for the Orc Empire, you know, even though wiping out the Orcs is almost an impossibility. But yeah, all the other huge galactic empires was gone, and the Imperium stood triumphant and, you know, said, okay, Horus, mop up the rest. I'm going to go work on this project. And I think that there was always going to be a point where the Space Marines had fulfilled their purpose and they needed to be replaced. Same as the Thunder Warriors. Like, the Emperor has been very good at using the tools for what they are and wielding them until they're redundant, then replacing them. And as you saw, the Emperor with the Webway project, which hopefully Tanya, you know a little bit about.
I do know a little bit about it, yes.
Yeah, hopefully with the Webway project, you saw him wanting to make things like navigators obsolete, things like the what's the beacon?
The Astronomicon.
The Astronomicon redundant. He wanted to, you know, he's slowly paring back all the need for contact with the warp, all the need for all these things. And it seems to me that if he made this pact with Chaos to make Primarchs, if he was paring back humanity's contact with the warp, you'd suspect that the Primarchs were going to be a redundant thing at some point and needed to be replaced.
No, I mean, this is, I don't want to get too spoilerific for people that have not read that far. And I'm trying to live in both worlds right now, because you are starting the series to where later in that series, it expands upon a lot of what you're talking about right now.
Nice. Good. Well, then this is a good place to discuss it. Cause if I don't have all the picture right now, I think that's exciting.
There is, but there's also, and I can't remember where it is in the books. It might even be, you know, the Gilliman walking back to talk to the Emperor after he's woken up. But there's those pillars to where, you know, essentially we're supposed to be like the final resting places of the Primarchs when they were no longer needed. And I don't know if that's theory or fact or suspicion.
Well, there's a lot of, there's so much up in the air, and that's it's truly amazing how much we have left to discover.
To go even further with the Space Marines, I believed that there was at least some credibility to the fact that there was a Space Marine. We think of them now, and maybe they are now, as just fighting death machines, just a living weapon capable of many, many things.
Well, and to that point, you've seen the degrading of the science used to construct them. Things like the Death Coming, things like the Wolfen, this kind of wearing down of the structures that keep these things, these, to all intents and purposes, machines, like you said, from functioning at optimum. It's quite interesting to see the tale over the 10,000 years. Like, I mean, Black Templars have fallen in their own way into zealotry, into crusading, into, like, not mindlessness, but almost like wearing blinkers and just seeing the world through a single mode of function, which would, you know, be abhorrent to the kind of 10,000 years ago, the Primarchs looking at their legions as, you know, Gilliman looking at them as scholars, as diplomats, as artists,
well,
et cetera,
that's
et cetera.
It. At the end of all this, the Space Marines, I believe, were going to be installed one per planet. It's like the governor of the planet.
Yep.
One each.
One each. Now, one of the reasons I think there was always going to be some, I don't want to say a cull, because of that's what happened to the Thunder Warriors. They met their end and they were culled off. I don't think, to your point, I don't think it's correct to say that they were always going to wipe each other, like they were going to be destroyed completely. But I do think the removal of the Primarchs was always necessary to some extent. Could you imagine what a Conrad Kurz in peacetime would look like? Like, what is that guy? Like, you know?
No, I think that you're right. There was definitely a plan to retire one way or another the Primarchs.
Yeah. Some of the things at the cause of these the humanities or the creations of these characters does not exist without a conflict. Angron, what is Angron if he doesn't have a focal point for all the vehemence and the anger inside him? What is that guy? The same could be said for, you know, for Gilliman. If there's nothing left to build, what does Gilliman become? If there's nothing left to tear down, what is Perturabo? You know?
Yeah, I think you're on. Oh,
sorry,
you're onto something.
Dawn, not yeah. Gilliman. But same for Gilliman. If Gilliman doesn't have a galaxy to build, if he doesn't have anything to administer,
yeah,
I suppose that's what he
becomes. An empire as a hobby. You know, those.
he just step right back into administration, get a nice cushy desk job. He'd be happy.
Yeah.
So have you guys read Legion?
Yes.
I actually, you know, so it's a sad story about me and Legion.
Uh-oh.
I went to a football game, caught the train, I took the book with me, and I read about two chapters there, and I left it in the stadium. Didn't bring it with me on the way home. Sat underneath my chair at a Western Bulldogs game somewhere in the Mars Stadium. In a stadium in Melbourne. And so I never finished that book.
You know what? I feel like I should just spoil it for you. For you've spoiled for me.
I know most of the plot points of the Heresy.
We got to respect the listeners. We can't spoil too much.
You can spoil it with you off air in the break and just be like, ha ha, take that, Adam.
Anyway, there's something that happens in that book that shows that somebody else had seen a possible outcome if the Horse Heresy didn't happen.
Yeah.
Right. So I know.
Yeah, I'm well aware.
You know all
that.
About
so,
that.
Yeah, yeah.
So if that person or persons could see this horrible outcome that would have happened if the Horus Heresy did not happen, well, then obviously the Emperor, since he is the greatest psyker that humanity has ever created, could obviously see that possible outcome as well. So maybe it is like you said, like maybe it is like the off switch or the way to make sure that other possible future doesn't happen.
Mm. Yeah, I think so. I like that added. What she's talking about is there's an influence of another race during the Horus Heresy trying to guide things towards a certain outcome, and it's a lovely little piece that G Double the Black Library writers have added in that adds a lot more intrigue. But another point I wanted to come to. So there was Thunder Warriors, and at the same time Thunder Warriors exist, the Emperor was able to create Custodes. Like, you know, those two things coexisted. That's like having a V8 supercar or a supercar, M1, you know, racer, and having your Datsun 500 or your Peewee 50 motorbike, you know? Those two things existed in the Emperor's arsenal at the same time. Not to be hugely disparaging to the Thunder Warriors, but they were built in a certain way to do a certain thing. And then you had this fully teched up, you know, roadster that, you know, like it was a beautiful old Mustang, the Custodes, you know, man. never going to not look good.
have you read Valdor?
I have not read Valdor.
Man,
yet,
see, you're just basically knocking on the, you have, the series is working for you, my friend. You are
beautiful. Beautiful. So you're saying I'm having the right thoughts at the right times.
I think that you are definitely, like, you're really getting all the subtext. You're getting a lot of what's in these novels, and I believe you'll see a payoff. At least, I mean, I'm not saying it's going to work out exactly like you're predicting or theorizing, but the subjects are going to be touched on from what you're talking about.
Well, so what this tells me, though, then the conclusion I came to that when I realized that these two things existed at the same time was that the Emperor had the ability to make custodies at the same time he was mass producing space marines. And I asked myself, why didn't he just make, you know, 100,000, 200,000, 500,000 custodies? He had 10,000 of them at the start of the Crusade. He always kind of had a bodyguard of 10,000 of these guys. So why not make 50,000, 100,000, 200,000? Why not use them to do the Great Crusade? And firstly, I talked to you guys off stage, and you're like, well, there's some lines in there saying that, you know, custodies are very hard to produce. They take a lot of energy to produce.
No spoilers. I don't know. I think that's the case.
Yeah. But that's the assumption people have put up. Even other people who I put this to have said that the custodies are far more hard to make. And you're perfectly right. And the other thing about the custodies, they are bred and created to be individual thinkers, to be almost self-starters, to, you know, think for themselves and act for themselves based on their own moralities. Space Marines are not. Space Marines are wholly and completely obedient to their Primarch and the Emperor by extension. Like you talk about on Mon Calera. Is that in First Heretic where the certain things happened on Mon Calera?
Monarchia?
Monarchia. Jeez, I suck. yes. So yes. You see the Emperor like actually just telling Space Marines what to do, and they have to obey. And you see the same effect of them happen with their Primarch throughout all the stories. The Primarch rocks up, and they have this obedience about them. Custodies are not built that way. So then why build Custodies that way? Why build Space Marines that way? Because you needed something that was mass-produced, that you could have an absolute godload amount, and there's the minimum investment for the most output. You know? This is the what's a really reliable car over there that won't die? To me, it'll be a Toyota Camry or a
Toyota Camrys. Probably right there.
Yeah. Unkillable, you know? But it's cheap, mass-produced, doesn't break down, off you go. That is a Space Marine, you know?
Have you read Outcast Dead?
No, I haven't.
Man,
can you reel off a book I have read? That'd be
great. Yeah, well, I'm saying that there's a scene. Outcast Dead does not get enough credit, if you ask me. Written by Graham McNeil. And there are some... Now, it largely happens on Terra. And there are some scenes in there where Space Marines fight somebody that you're not immediately sure of who or what it is, but it becomes like real apparent, and it helps put some of the stuff that you're talking about in some cool context. And again, you start to think about things in the ways that you didn't necessarily think about them before, which is what I like to get out of a book.
Perfect. Yeah, perfect. I love to have my this, especially when I'm invested in a single, you know, not exactly linear plot. I like to just have little bits and pieces added to it because it just brings so much more to the payoff at the end, hopefully, when we get to the end. But the extension here was, hey, he could have created Custodes, but he created Space Marines. So why would he do that? Oh, it's because he always wanted to have a check and a balance to his creations. E.g., the Primarch who checks and balances to each other. There was, you know, so many fell, so many were always going to fall, so many were always going to not. There are checks and balances to each other. And the Custodes were existed because when they first created the Thunder Warriors, he needed a check and balance to them. And then they were also the same check and balance to the Space Marines because the Emperor always wanted to have something more powerful than the thing he was wielding. And that was the thought that came into my head. So, yeah, exactly. Why do Space Marines want to do, you know, Legions of Custodes? It's because, oh, well, if the Custodes turn, the hell are you going to do? You know, after the Custodes turn, I am wrecked. You know, we are so screwed. And so, e.g., he couldn't allow something that powerful to exist because, you know, who knows if he could be able to control it or reel it back in if he needed to. And so then I'm like, then how can he have not have planned all of it? How can he not have planned all this redundancy in? And this was just like his next version of the iPhone. You know, it was all only built to exist for one, you know, stamped on the side. Every Space Marine picks up their boot and like, good for one Great Crusade, you know, trademark Emperor 3.0, you know, how it's just another iPhone to him that he's just mass produced and put out into the world. And he's just going to have another version until where I think the things that happened that were outside of his control and the things that I don't think he predicted. And I think the big one there was what Magnus did. I think what Magnus did, because of his overreaction to what Magnus did, as in like, scorched earth policy, genocide, or wipe him off, is because it was so far out of his realm of possibility, his predictions, that he went off the rails, lost the plot, and everything started going south from there. At least that's my assumption. That's the way I see it.
That sounds plausible.
If they were supposed to fall, if it was always supposed to go, I don't think Magnus was originally part of the group that, if the Emperor thought some were going to fall, was going to fall. I think he didn't predict half. He probably predicted a third or, you know, whatnot.
No, he definitely planned to install Magnus on the Golden Throne.
Exactly right. He always did. So therefore, he would never have predicted Magnus was going to fall and never would have created him something that powerful that he was never going to have full control over. Therefore, when Magnus did what he did, it really upturned the apple cart. These are the conclusions I'm coming to. And that was the... far more significant event than Horus turning, because I always think he predicted at some level his Primarchs would turn against him.
This actually leads into the conversation. We'll take a break. We'll leave them on that cliffhanger. Yeah, and we actually talk a little bit about lore and some of the retcons over the years, and maybe, and then also the double reason why we are seeing Primarchs in Warhammer 40,000 today kind of thing in the next bit of the conversation.
Beautiful.
So let's let folks listen to that, and then we'll come back and talk about the hobby segment.
See you then.
We'll see you in a bit.
FTN is brought to you by Discount Games Inc. Please visit them at www.discountgamesinc.com. And don't forget to ask Jay about ways to save even more on your hobby projects.
Hey everybody, welcome to a very special segment of Forge the Narrative. My name is Paul. I'm joined by Vince, otherwise known as Pleasant Kenobi. Vince, how you doing, man?
Hello, Paul. I'm good, my friend. I'm very, very good. It's a very warm, heat-struck England right now, but besides that, I'm fantastic.
I've heard about that. I hope it cools down. I know it's unseasonably warm where you are right now.
Yeah, it's like the world's on fire almost, isn't it? Yeah, it's hot, it's sweaty. I'm currently practically naked. I am wearing some undergarments, but I'm yeah.
What a powerful vision that we are creating.
The best way to talk about 40K is in the nudie.
Hey, you know, it's hard to argue with that. Well, thanks for joining me, man. I follow your content mostly. You produce a lot of Magic the Gathering content. You've been on the show before, so people may be familiar, but anybody who's not, you've got some great topics, great conversation on YouTube. I follow you on Twitter as well.
Yeah. I'm a full-time, to just give the spiel a little bit, I'm a full-time content creator. I make YouTube content like 5 to 7 days a week around Magic and also 40K. 40K is a bit more sporadic. It depends. My main focus is Magic, so sometimes I have to let 40K fall to the wayside as I have a spoiler season for Magic that we do this week, for example. And then I Twitch stream at least once a week Magic, often once a week 40K on tabletop as well. Got super into the hobby. I think I was on your podcast, I want to say 12 months ago, maybe a bit longer. Was it about a year ago?
That seems about right, yeah.
Yeah. We talked through my entry into the hobby, and since then I've just got deeper and deeper. And now I've attended a couple of events. I've got a couple of GTs in my future calendar, and I'm loving it. I'm absolutely loving it.
One of the things that originally got me to reach out to you in the first place is that you are. So you also do some content on some partner channels as well.
Yes.
And you would occasionally just like slip in some just random 40K reference. I was like, wait a second, I know what he's talking about.
Yeah. So there's a bit of a running joke on my channel for a while. It's died off on my channel a little bit that we can't go too long without me mentioning Warhammer. So I would be playing Magic the Gathering and I'll just call something a unit by accident instead of a card. And I do it vice versa. I'll be playing Warhammer and I'll call something a card instead of a unit or model. So my vernacular would slip. And also, yeah, on stream and on calls with my patrons that I hang out with once a week, things just obviously often descend into like, what are we building? What are we painting? It's just that sort of stuff.
At the time we talked about you basically jumping all in, you had several, you know, very early on, you had a couple of different armies, you were beginning to learn how to paint and really embracing it. And then, you know, I've seen that continue even to the point now where you're hitting up tournaments.
Yeah, I'm giving it a go. I have a silly amount of armies now. Last time we spoke, I think I was on like 3. I'm on like maybe 6 or 7, well over 2,000 points. I've got like 20,000 points of 40K in like 18 months. It's been a bit wild. And I've been playing Sisters competitively. Not to a great standard, I won't lie. I came 9th at the Hellstorm, into the Hellstorm, I want to say Chainsword, I don't remember which one they're called, about a month ago. And then about 3 weeks ago, I played again the same list. And then I struggled to a 2-3 finish. So sometimes you take a list and you do well.
Look, the dice are going to be what the dice do. Sometimes the matchups are going to, don't get discouraged.
No, 100%. I think matchups were a big bit. And I also think my list... that was a list that I put together very quickly. So I booked into these two tournaments quite late notice. I had like 2 weeks to go. I had 400 points of Sisters painted. And I was like, okay, I've got to decide on a list, submit them 2 weeks out from both tournaments. So there's like literally tomorrow when I decided to go to these events. And then I had to paint up that stuff in that 2 weeks. So I had to settle on it very early. And I was playing it a lot online as well. And I was like, oh, actually, I don't have the action monkeys. I can't deploy scramblers. So I had melter spam. My list was designed to kill whatever it could and hope to dodge Admech. And for the most part, I did. I didn't play Admech across 2 GTs, which was nice. Did play against Drukhari, though, which wrecked me.
No, but, they got a lot of tools.
Exactly. So I set on a list way too early and then learned that list and realized I had things I needed to change. But when you lock in a list for an event, you obviously can't change it.
Well, you're living in basically like two different worlds, you know, being between Magic and Warhammer 40,000. I'm kind of curious, you know, what you think the similarities are, because these are both what I've noticed from some of your content and your discussion on social media is that you like to live in the lore space a bit as well.
Yeah, I think I'm just a massive nerd, like too much of a big nerd, right? Like I like competing. I like science fiction and fantasy fiction. I like you said, the lore, the canon. So I think I get really into hobbies on an almost all encompassing basis. So everything about 40K, I like playing, I like painting. I've been listening to the audiobooks. I'm like on book 4, The Horus Heresy at the moment. Listen to a few others as well. I have, but the thing is with The Horus Heresy is that if I'm painting Sisters of Battle, I'm going to swap out and go listen to, not Faith and Fury, what was it called? Faith and Devotion? The first recent book when the box set came out. So I swapped to other books. I listened to like Watchers on the Throne when I was painting my Custodes, the Lords of Silence when I was painting Death Guard. So that's the reason I'm so not, I've already done like 4 books of Horus Heresy. But yeah, I love all facets of it. And I think getting into the lore of 40K has made me reflect on the lore of Magic a bit more. And my content has reflected that recently where I've done like videos deep diving on characters in Magic. I did like a genre study for like Innistrad and stuff. But that's because of 40K and how much I'm enjoying that lore. It's making me look back on something that Magic and Wizards of the Coast could do better to cultivate themselves. They kind of abandoned it at points, where obviously GW, they embrace it, right? They have a subsidiary that pumps out a book a week, doesn't it?
It's the Black Library. Let's do a shameless plug. They're amazing.
Yeah, and I wish Magic had something like that. Like the last couple of novels that we got, I mean, World of Quest was okay, but there was a couple that were so bad, they're so universally panned, that all they were like memes and like bombing reviews on YouTube and stuff. And I think that scared Wizards off. Like they were really bad, my friend. Like, if anyone wants to know how bad they were, there's a great review of War of the Spark by Tolarian Community College, the professor, my podcast co-host, and he is an ex-English professor, and he just rips it a new one in very eloquent and very concise ways. It's terrible. So I wish Wizards cared about the lore as much as Games Workshop does, or at least would put the money and resources into decent novels and stuff. They have short stories, but it's not the same.
I like his content as well. He's not afraid to unleash, you know, some opinions.
Yes, he is. I love Brian. He is often, his comments are people calling him a shill or whatever, but then when you watch the video, like, he's very direct and very honest about how he feels about Wizards. Sometimes I try to rein him in because he's so skeptic of, you know, of the company and stuff. But you see that on both sides of the pond. You see that with Magic and Warhammer, right? Some content creators are willing to criticize the parent company and other ones steer away from doing so.
With the lore in Magic, I don't think outside of tribal decks, and when I say tribal decks, decks that have a common theme for a specific creature type or something that typically they benefit each other, like other things in that tribe get a certain benefit. I don't know if I've ever seen a deck that is like really representative of the lore. Is it really that absent in Magic? And have you really compared the two in your mind or whatever about maybe influencing your 40K list? Do you think there's some aspect that's creeping out and maybe how you do your list in 40K?
I think you're very right there. Like in 40K, even if you build a competitive 40K list, it will often, just by virtue of how the army systems, the codices work, the army building system in the game within the confines of the rules, your armies will still be able to come out like even moderately fluffy. Like, for example, you wouldn't get a Death Guard army with a random, not what you used to back in the day, but with a random Tau, like, drone or whatever in it, right? But in Magic, there are just no rules to how you build stuff, really. There are decks that are 5 color, they don't have any lands, and they're just there to abuse a loop or a combo or whatever. So I think you're right. That is one of the other sides of it. I'm saying how the parent company doesn't care enough to put out good novels. They put out some, but not many. Which is obviously a stark contrast to GW's attitude. But you are right, the game itself doesn't invite you or incentivize you or like just mechanically work in a way that is lore consistent. Where Warhammer, although people would say like, you know, the AdMech shooty Skitarii spam lists probably aren't lore appropriate.
It is right on brand. It actually, it's not, I'm not saying it's particularly enjoyable to play against that if you didn't come prepared for it, but it's on brand.
Is the Skitarii list lore accurate?
I believe it is. Yeah, I mean, that's a faction.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I don't know, because I haven't read the Mars Civil War yet. Because outside looking in, 18 months ago, when I was looking at Warhammer Wishing I played it, as a kid who played back in 3rd edition, I always thought the AdMech were like tech priests and big robots. And they kind of were that when we had like breaches and cataphrons, right? And then the new codex has come out and it's Skitarii spam. And I'm like, that's not the AdMech that I knew. But in all fairness, I'm looking from outside in and I've never read a book about them.
Well, as you're going through this, your Horus Heresy journey, you're actually going to come across a couple of AdMech books. And so maybe it'd be cool to reconnect and see it'd be fresher in your mind. We'll plan this out.
That is interesting though, isn't it? That I might have this complete wrong, like misconception of how AdMech are meant to look. But to your point, you are right. Magic doesn't work in that space. Decks are rarely on theme. It happens in Commander a little bit. I have friends who are obsessed with building like themed decks. Like a friend of mine just built a D&D themed deck, not just around the new D&D set, but like around having the correct classes in the deck and cards that represent things from D&D. Because some people do play the theme, but like that's never going to happen in a modern or legacy or standard tournament ever.
Commander is a particular format for Magic, the card game where you're playing 100 card decks with only one copy of each card that you choose to put in your deck outside of like basic lands.
Yeah, and it's multiplayer and it's a lot more relaxed, and the whole point is to play what you want. It's probably closest to open play borderline crusade in the sense that you do what you want and you have conversations beforehand with your friend about what kind of game you're expecting. Well, if you walk up to play standard, legacy or modern, you're walking up to a local event, maybe a GT, where if your opponent is going to like shoot you off the table, you can't really be mad about what they brought to the table because them's the rules, right? It's a competitive environment. So yeah, Commander is probably the closest you get to that open play environment where people will play themed decks. They will play decks that are like women looking left tribal, or like everybody's got to wear hats. Like you can go wild with the themes in Commander.
Only beards, yeah. You know. That's yeah.
There is definitely a beard deck out there somewhere. I think someone made one for my channel as like a birthday like list submission.
Oh, that's glorious!
Only counts with beards. So yeah, that's more like open play.
I've heard you say this before, and I think I've actually used this as an example. Is that Magic seems to have a finite amount of fun that can happen on the game table. And
yes.
And one player wants to control all of that.
Yes, yes. I do think that happens in Warhammer, though, too. I think that's the thing that's very similar.
See, my question is, do you find that as prevalent? You know, because look, I mean, you're very knowledgeable about Magic, and I know you're on at least some point in a journey with Warhammer. I'm curious how you're doing these comparisons, or if you are doing these comparisons in your mind.
Yeah, 100%. Like, Warhammer is the same thing. It happens for any game where two players play off against each other, right? And there's something on the line, or there's a win at the end of it. Like, if someone is shooting all your models off the table and you're just picking up stuff and you're just losing, like my experiences, to be fair, playing against the current AdMech Codex have been not great. They've been pretty miserable. Obviously, you can look at them as learning experiences. Like I did end up playing against an Alex. I forget his surname. He's an LVO winner. He was my second pairing at my first ever GT. He was playing Iron Hand Successor List and he shot me off the table. He killed like 1,000 points turn one, maybe more. And that was weirdly enjoyable because my invuln sayings were going badly. So that was like adding to the absurdity of it all. Mm. And even he was saying out loud, like, my army's meant to abuse this, like, you know, terrain setup, but this is ridiculous. And then I rolled my first six on a rhino, so it blew up and killed 10 more girls. And I was like, this is just ridiculous.
Man.
But my point is, that was fun because I learned a lot. Like, when I saw, like, the way he was using drop pods plus incursors plus the forward deploying battle suits, what they call
using the physics of the game.
Yeah, exactly. The physicality, the space and stuff. Like, there was stuff to learn there. I mean, we had a good discussion around it. But he was having all the fun in terms of like in-game mechanics, outside of the metagame of it. He was just killing everything and I stood no chance. And I think that Magic and Warhammer have the same thing, where if you're getting stomped, which happens if you're a good player playing like the best thing, then yeah, there is a finite amount of fun to be had and you're going to feel salty when the dice don't go your way, or you don't draw what you needed, or your opponent just smashes you.
Do you find it any easier to maybe dig out of what might be a game going south in the first couple of turns, as opposed to in Magic, if you get behind, there's very little prayer of coming back?
I'd say Warhammer has got more room to control what's happening because you have agency over what your army is and what it does. And then obviously the dice provide some variance. But obviously you're playing to what the averages of the dice are going to give you, right? You never play to like the low odds or the high odds. You're trying to play to the averages. Where in Magic,
I would just for average dice. Like, please, well, I mean, please give me average dice.
I believe in a long enough timeline, everyone averages out. I've been trying to convince my community to stop moaning about bad dice rolls and stop moaning
about
bad.
It is true.
Top
you don't recognize when you rolled average, you know, you quickly forget that. That almost immediately evaporates away from your brain as soon as it happens. But you'll remember
yeah, definitely. Points. And I've been trying to remember the games where I rolled hot, but also you do get the situation in Warhammer where your opponent will tell you that you rolled hot when you probably didn't. So that could also skew, but then I'd lose that. Oh, I think you rolled hot, man. I think I rolled pretty average. Like, you know, people don't look for their mistake point or their failure point being their mistake, do they? A lot of people would like to put luck in the hands of the gods, as it were, and not admit defeat. But that's not the question you asked me. I think Magic has more non-games. I think Magic has more games where nothing was going right and there's no way to come back from that. You just mulligan. So you draw your opening hand, you have one land. You mulligan down to six, one land. You mulligan to five, one land. At that point, you're so behind on chances to win. And that can happen with alpha strikes and stuff in Warhammer. But again, your deployment matters. What guns they've got matters. What armor and infantry you've brought matters. There's more control over non-games in Warhammer, I feel, except for when dumb books are released.
Yeah, so you know we touched a little bit on this with lore being such a factor. Is how are you picking your armies that you're choosing to play? Are you getting kind of attracted to the figures themselves or the story behind them? Yeah, and then does that make its way to the table?
All the figures are so pretty. That's the big thing about GW, right? They make the best models in the world, and that's why I'm kind of collecting everything, Paul. It's like you are right. Like Sisters being this gorgeous model range, like the Exorcist, the Immolator, and their Rhino basically drew me in, and now I love Sisters, and they're the army I'm playing competitively, or was. I'm probably going to get 1,000 Sons for the next events and stuff.
All right, it's a powerful army, but it is. It's going to be challenging.
What, 1,000 Sons? Yeah. I mean, the fact that Magnus has access to, like, is it 16, 18 spells? I don't know the exact number. I've played him, like, 3 or 4 times so far, and there's decision paralysis. It's great as a Magic player, because it feels like you're looking at a sideboard, the 15 cards you have outside the game to change how you play.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of options, a lot of utility, but again, that gives you, when you've got options, you've got more chances to make mistakes, right? But yeah, I'm not lore fixed. Like my orcs, I'm probably never going to get them up to being a competitive build. I'm probably just going to do a lot of kit bashing and mucking about. I'm painting a Gazgul right now, even though like every website on the internet tells me that Gazgul is trash. But I'm painting him because he's a cool model.
Sometimes he really just works out, though. I mean, you're right. I think ultimately the orcs are going to have a little bit of time before they settle into what the, you know, the no fat lists are.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the competitive build that people might be settling on is was it 9. Megatrack, the Screw Jets, and then like 9 Squig Buggies. It's buggy spam, right? Mm-hmm. And I don't think I'll ever, if I was wanting to play orcs competitively, I probably would buy, build, and paint them. But chasing the metagame is kind of silly because things change so much, right? Like the way I was building Sisters even a month or two ago is going to look silly once we get the next couple of codexes because it all changes so much.
Do you, I'm drawing some comparisons to Magic here, but you know, being able to really explore the depth of a codex when the meta shifts and still being able to play, I'll equate it to the colors or the archetype that you want. Are you finding that to be something you can do?
I would say, in the way that I said, there's a benefit to Warhammer having less non-games. I think one of the detriments to Warhammer at a competitive level is that adjusting to the metagame is far more difficult in terms of like the hobby lag, the time, and the monetary investment of buying kits and building them, then for them to be out of date within another month or two. Where with Magic, there's a monetary commitment to getting staples, but like you can slide a card in and out of a sleeve, like, you know, between games if you had to or could do. So I think the ability to adjust the metagame is much more open in Magic for everyone. Where in Warhammer, again, I'm not at the top tables here, so maybe I'm talking out of my here, but
no, this is perspective. I'm curious what you're, you know, as you're, again, you're kind of on this journey.
Like, I think with Warhammer, it's really, there is a top tier of players who the competitive game is their life or a big part of their life. And they have the money, the time, the effort, and the ability to chase the metagame by shifting between armies or having huge collections or just building and painting the next big thing, right? To go from like playing 120 Skitarii Vanguard to 9 of one buggy and 9 of another is a huge jump in both time, money, and commitment to paint and stuff. But people are doing it. I just don't think that's easy for the average player. So I've been trying to tell people who are getting into Warhammer, want to go to events, don't worry about chasing the metagame. Like, it's not really worth it. It's worth it because then you can compete.
Well, I mean, competition, but... you know, I think there's different aspects to it. I mean, you really get to, you know the ins and outs of your army. You know when it's time to change your plan up during the course of a game. And also the secondaries. I mean, that's another thing I want to talk about, picking secondaries and that kind of stuff, is that can really, when you really know what your army can do, the game opens up, gets a little easier for you.
Exactly. I think people get bogged down with having the correct army composition or the correct counter pick to someone else's army composition way earlier than they get bogged down with the idea of like, what are my secondaries or, or how how much CP do I need in my list to facilitate my stratagem plan? And there are a lot of other things, like you said, that are fundamentals of the game that will probably give you more percentage points in your final score at a tournament than trying to have the correct way to beat these scrapjet buggies. Because again, you'll probably spend all your time and effort trying to do that, and the scrapjet buggies will be out of the loop in a month's time when like cheese killer cults come out or whatever. So yeah, I think there are other areas that newer players, including myself, should be focusing on. So secondaries are hard. Secondaries and deployment are the two hardest parts of the game, I'd say.
They really are. And then mastering the movement phases and all that. So I mean, if you got anybody that's new, you know, like just really focusing in on every time you interact and moving a model, that is could potentially be a game-winning decision.
Yeah. The movement phase is the most important phase of the game, and people should spend more time thinking during that step, right? That's another thing I've been trying to champion a little bit as I lead these. There's a lot of new people, players on my Discord and stuff, and I'm no expert by all means. People are listening to this thinking, who's this magic playing idiot? But I'm trying to like encourage like good practices at least. And I think The movement phase, I mean, there are a phase that's super important, like the movement you can get out of like charging, for example, in certain armies, or how you utilize the psychic phase and sequencing is important. But the movement phase is hands down the most important one in terms of like it enables every other. It's like a cascade effect, right? It enables everything else.
Now, on that gameplay side of things, you know, is there a correlation to magic of, you know, knowing when to tap, not, you know, if you've got options, how to properly weigh out your options to make sure that you don't overcommit or undercommit or make a mistake that shuts off one of your doors for another play, even in the same phase?
Yeah, kind of. Like the biggest comparison to like deployment / secondaries, that's the hardest part, is probably mulliganing in Magic. Like look at your opening hand and understanding what your deck can do with said cards, and like what your chances of drawing the other cards in your deck that you need to see. So there might be a four of in your deck because you can play four of any card. And you're like, oh, I need this card. And if your deck doesn't draw any more cards, if it just draws one card a turn, so by turn five, you're looking at 12 cards in your deck, and you haven't got that four of in your opening hand, then it's probably a mulligan. And it's those sort of conversations that are one of the hardest ones to have as a new player, opening hands and mulligan decisions. But once you move away from that, the games start to look extremely different. There is a resource trading element to both games. Like we often talk in 40K about, you know, trading up or trading down. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just a battle. One of the things they're so good at doing is throwing 100 to 150 points at a larger point total and killing it. At mech, of course, the same with their 200 points Qatari blobs, just deleting like 400 points worth of stuff. There is a bit of that in Magic with trading card for card. If your deck can accrue those cards back by drawing more cards off of card draw engines. And there's also tempo as well, which is a weird comparison. Because in Warhammer, you have a finite five turns. And if you can't, like, you know, if you have a Terminator in the back corner that you deep struck in to deploy a scrambler, and now it needs to be in the mid-board to hold an objective, and you've got two turns to get there, sometimes you physically just cannot get there. And that was one of the hardest things for me to get my head around getting into 40K. Like, you have a limited amount of time. In Magic, the game is infinite in length, in theory, but there is things like if you cast seven mana, seven of your lands tapped into a seven mana spell, and your opponent stops it with a two mana spell, there is like a mana advantage tempo element there, but it's on a different axis. It's not like a time thing, right? It's about resources in the moment. It's almost like CP in a way. Mm-hmm. So there are comparisons, but they're loose because the games do play like quite differently.
Yeah, it's interesting. No, thanks for spending a little time on that. That's I used to be heavy into Magic a long time ago, and now I'm like the definition just a casual.
Yeah. Well, you said you're grinding quite a lot on Arena, right?
Oh yeah, I grind Arena. You know, I make my goal. I get my quest. I accumulate my wild cards and open up, you know, as many free packs as I can get.
Right? Was that? You said you're a casual, and someone says they're a casual Warhammer player. Like, how many hours of Magic do you play a week? Do you reckon?
You know, I'd say a solid 5-6 hours.
Yeah. At what point do you stop being a casual? Like, you're casually painting up your models, but you're not going to a tournament, but you spend like 10 hours a week painting Warhammer models. Are you really a casual Warhammer enthusiast?
It's an interesting question. It's like, when does the switch flip? And what is one person's casual to other?
Yeah, exactly. Because like, there's this dichotomy that happens in Magic, and I think we see it in 40K too, is of competitive and for fun or casual, right? People say, oh, I'm not playing competitively, I'm playing for fun, which in itself is a statement that suggests that competitive play can't be fun, which is obviously ridiculous.
Oh, no, I don't think that's true. I mean, I know that's not what you're saying, but I definitely don't think that. I mean, I love that.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. But I think the language of the communities sort of sound like that a little bit. And there's this casual versus competitive thing. There's got to be a scale in the middle. Well, and I think a lot of people are further towards the serious side of the hobbies than they think they are. If they're reading the news stories, buying the books and paying the models, even if they're not hitting up the local like GT or Open or whatever.
So I think in this, you know, I've been thinking about this for the last 30 seconds or so, is that I could sit down and play magic for that period of time. And if I lose 10 games in a row, as long as I'm completing my daily quest or whatever the online, you know, carrot is leading me down.
Yeah.
And lose every game, I'm okay with it. If I were to sit down and play two or three games of 40K and come away with a losing record, I'm back to the drawing board, figuring out what's wrong. Well, what series of cascade failures has led me to this event of losing a few games in a row.
So I guess you're more willing to put the time in with 40K, I guess what you're saying, right? To learn to be better, where Magic, it's just not really... You win, you lose, you lose. But with Warhammer, you want to improve?
Yeah, but even with the Magic, like I understand and I'm okay with the fact that I am competing with limited resources. I have not gone to the lengths of making sure I have a playset of everything or the most efficient version of whatever this effect is or whatever. I'm content with my level of skill versus my commitment of investment, whether that be time, money, resources, or whatever.
But with 40K, I guess you don't want to be restricted by your access to game pieces then?
No, I want to get whatever I think. Well, you know, there's an element of, I want my looks cool. I'm gonna, if they put out a Blood Angel unit tomorrow, I'm getting it. I don't care what it is or what its stats are. It could be a winged blood paperweight, and it's getting bought and painted.
Paul, that was my next question, was on this casual versus competitive thing, right? You're building Ad Mech at the moment, right? Have you got to play them yet?
Ad Mech and Death Guard, yeah. I have not played them in a tournament setting, though.
Okay. Oh, no, that's what I meant. Sorry, have you got to play them out like a tournament setting?
But, I have not.
Yeah. My next question was going to be, like, you know, you're talking about casual versus competitive. We're talking about lore versus gameplay and stuff, right? But you know tomorrow you'll be building, basing, and painting a Blood Angel unit if it came out. That's literally my next question to you, because I'm the same. I'm super wanting to compete, but I also want to, like, kit bash some Star Wars stuff to, like, orcs, and I'll paint anything Blood Angels they put out because I love the faction. So
I'm really pleased to hear that, by the way. But that's one of the things about this hobby, is that you can really live in it. And that's, so there seemed to be almost like a flash in the pan controversy for the Modern Horizons.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, Historic Horizons or whatever it is.
It's called Jumpstart Historic Horizons. That's why you can't remember. It's a four-word name. It's a confusing one.
Yes, and there's these cards in there, and a couple of them reference... look, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm not trying to tell you anything, or if anybody's listening from your side of the shop, forgive me for butchering all of this, but, do things like you can conjure tropical islands and black lotuses and those kinds of things.
Yes, so they do. So the black lotus one was actually a physical card, so I'll come back to that in a minute. There was cards released that are digitally unique, digitally mechanically unique, which means that they are cards on Arena that do things on Arena that physical cards could not do. So, for example, there is a removal spell that has a perpetual mechanic where it will change the stats on an enemy creature or one of your creatures, as the case may be, and that stat change will follow it anywhere it goes, into the library, graveyard, hand, exile, hidden zone, unhidden zone, whatever. Its stats will stay the same, and it's tracked by the computer, where in paper you couldn't do that without some very clunky, like, token that has to be on it, and it couldn't go into the library because you couldn't shuffle it in with the token and so on and so on. And there was controversy there because a lot of people feel like this is the barn doors being broken open. This is the floodgates. This is Pandora's box of us moving towards a world where digital magic looks nothing like physical magic. And I'm kind of in that camp where I think the way they've done it, where they put it into this format called Historic, which is my favorite format in the online space, means that space now doesn't exist in paper. You can't just go to a game store and say, do you want to build historic decks and run historic events? Because some of these cards just do not exist in physical and never will do. And I do think 40K players would have lost their shit as well if there was a similar situation in Warhammer. However, there's no digital client, and there probably never will be at this rate, or not for a good long time. So I guess Warhammer will never have to deal with a similar situation.
Got it. As things progress, you know, do you think that that path is, as long as both formats are supported, you know?
Yes, as long as everything's supported, as long as, like, paper magic continues, the paper magic formats are continued and so on, then there's no real problem with it, right? It's a shame that Historic, being this new exciting thing, will never really see paper play. But as long as they're all supported, yeah. And I've been playing a lot of Historic, and I like the gameplay, the mechanical ability of these cards. I think a lot of them lead to fun situations. My only bugbear was that it was in Historic particularly. Other people, on the other hand, are calling it Hearthstone, which is... It's such a wild thing as well. It's like Magic's not allowed to learn from other successful games. It's not allowed. It's so big it can't fail and therefore can't learn from other games, right? This is the funny thing. So people call them Hearthstone cards. I mean, I'm doing it jokingly because it's funny, but some people are like, oh, I'm never playing Arena again. Some people are like commenting on my videos saying, I can't believe you're playing with these cards, Vince. How can you do this to us? And some people have taken it as like an affront to their own.
Well, it challenges. And that's kind of where, I mean, I think I'm jumbled my question, but you know, with that, for that instance of where that dude conjures the Black Lotus in the physical space, is like, that is a character from one of the old lore books who, yep, I'm assuming could actually perform those types, yeah, of tasks.
So One-Eyed Garth, what your friend, is a card that can, when you tap it, it makes one of four different cards that would exist in Magic. It makes a token of it that can be cast immediately. So it's different to Conjure, because Conjure makes an object that sticks around. Like the Black Lotus would go to the graveyard, for example, if it was conjured in the digital space with these new cards. So it does do it. But Garth is from an old book, and he was incredibly powerful. I haven't read the book. I know very little about him, apart from the fact that he exists.
Well, that's, but, whereas if this was a Warhammer 40,000 character, we would probably both know everything about it.
Yeah, exactly. There are wikis for Magic, but even the Magic wiki is like bare bones compared to 40k wikis. I guess that's a good thing and a bad thing there, because I do get the impression that the 40k wikis are sometimes wrong, and you'll chat to people who have evidently never read one of the books and are just like verbatim reading off wiki stuff to you. You're like, and that's not a bad thing. There's nothing wrong with wiki diving. It's fun. But it is interesting that there's almost like a secondary, like a secondhand lore. Like someone's read the book, someone's made a video, someone's watched the video, someone's written the wiki. At that point, we've got like, you know, 3 degrees of separation.
Doubling down of what could be right. And I actually, so I'm a comic guy. Like, I love comics. I love reading comics. I've been associated with comics, you know, plus or minus some basically in all my life since 10 years old or whatever.
Are you a superhero comic fan?
Or yeah, superhero comics. Yeah.
DC or Marvel?
Marvel.
Oh, okay.
All the way Marvel.
I love Marvel, don't get me wrong, but I was a big DC head for like about 5 years.
I'm okay with it. Like, okay, let me say, in my advanced years here, I've become okay with all different types of fan involvement, including the filthy casual wiki reading of...
Yeah, that's how I got into comics, though. That's how I got into it. Was just wiki diving DC comic wiki, loving it, loving all this complicated and convoluted lore and canon. And I'm like, right, I'm gonna go read Infinite Crisis, Crisis on Infinite Earths, and like that got me into it. So like, wikis have their place and they're useful. Don't get me wrong. So please, people listening at home, don't think I'm some sort of like.
I think your wiki page just got updated with a.
I wish I had a Wikipedia page.
So with this, you know, with these characters coming in, do you think people, like, if they were going to advance the things a certain way, like when you bring these ultra powerful things into the game, yeah, should they even be there? How do they justify it? Would it be too much of a compromise if they brought in the characters without all this extra power that we may see get souped up in some sets?
They do it all the time. There's so many random like callbacks every other set. They're very, this is the weird thing, right? They're not very good at cultivating the lore outside of the game. So like, there are novels and most of them are terrible. They're short stories that for the most part are good, but they paywalled them for a while as well. They even have one novel written by Sanderson, I think it is, where he gave the book to Frida Wizards and they, on the condition they didn't sell it, and they sold it anyway. So they have a very bad relationship with the metatextual fiction. But inside the game world, inside the cards themselves, the people at Wizards are very good at what they do. The designers, the creative team, the world-building team, they are phenomenal. So we constantly get callbacks and references and little Easter eggs in the art. So it's not just like Garth, the one I got the Black Lotus, and that's the one everyone knows about. Like, we had Urza cards recently. We've had, like, different references to, like, the orreries on Mirrodin and all this stuff that's just going to sound like gobbledygook to somebody who's not super fantastic in Magic. But they do that a lot, and it's really good. So don't get me wrong. There is an element of it that's wonderful and great, normally in the card art and the flavor text and that part of the world building. I just wish the company on a larger scale could at least look at GW across the pond and be like, huh, they're probably making probably millions of pounds at this point from these books. Maybe we should do the same.
But... Well, I'm just happy you get to exercise whatever this part of you that is living inside burning over here in the Warhammer 40,000 space.
Do you know what's an interesting thing? Before we close down this conversation completely on lore and stuff, is that I think, and maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong here, that Warhammer didn't really, or 40K specifically, didn't really release its old canonical characters until more recently. So we had a return of like Gulliman, Mortarion, and Magnus, all before I got into the game. I got back into the game just after like Mephiston had got his remake and stuff, right? So these characters are all coming back. And then we obviously had Horus Heresy, which has then gave you all these background characters and models and stuff for them. But Magic's been doing that for a very long time. Is that fair to say that Warhammer had kind of a static collection of characters and most of them were just legendary?
Well, it goes even deeper than that. That some of them, oh yes, there's a wide universe. Like there's the universe is massive, and you know there's stories to be told all over the place because of how big it was. And some of these characters, for a brief period of time, existed in some capacity. I'm talking like first edition. You know, we're on ninth edition, kind of. You know, first edition, many many years ago, and they. I guess some of them only existed as like models or as maybe they were captains, you know, and not this Primarch status. But as the game evolved, you know, these figures got pushed up into like mythic capacity and weren't as a part of the game as a playable model. They were there kind of behind the scenes. You know, you were acting kind of as agents of them or something like that.
Is Gulliman a good example of that? Was it, he was originally a captain or something and then got retconned to be more, and eventually that became the name of the Primarch? Were the Primarchs not named originally?
Something like, yeah, that and Gilliman and Lehman Russ, several of those, you know, as the story started to solidify. Now, and this solidified only over a couple of years, and reams and reams of amazing stories have been built off of what were several paragraphs in a book.
So retcons in a way, right?
Yes, but it has been so long ago that I don't even know that if we can really consider them retcons.
Yeah, that's fair. But it's would you say it's a more recent phenomenon that we're getting, the old characters coming back? People coming out of the warp and demon. Like, when I was a kid, Primarchs were a thing mentioned in the BBB, the big black book, the third edition book. And the idea of there being a Primarch in the game, they were like super beings, right?
Yep.
And then I come back and I'm like, oh, who's this big blue guy? And my friend's like, oh, that's Gilliman, Primarch of the Ultramarines. And something in me like could remember, like, a Primarch in Warhammer? Like, it was shocking that they brought these things back. Is that more of a recent development in 40K, would you say? Like since 7th edition?
It is. So the demon Primarchs used to exist in a game called Epic. You know, they had tiny little models. But now, I believe the model making capacity in Games Workshop, and you mentioned this before, they do make the best models in the world, and they're so talented at it. I think they have the capacity to kick out these, you know, just jaw-dropping, iconic things. And so
the old Magnus model that I've seen, the old one-eyed dude with the staff in the air, is that an Epic model?
That's Epic, yeah. That thing's an inch tall.
Oh, that's why he's so small. That makes so much sense.
Yeah, that's it.
So I guess they were in the game at some point. So Magnus had a stat sheet for Epic, which we're talking like, that's like second edition era, right? And then he didn't have a 40K sheet till the 7th edition, which is like, what, 20 years later almost?
That's right.
Crazy, isn't it?
That's exactly right. That's it.
That's similar to what Magic does, but Magic's been doing it like on and on. Like they've been doing like the nostalgia. It's kind of, I guess, what Horus Heresy books do for Warhammer fans, but Magic have been doing sets where they're just like, here's an old character you never heard of. You remember from Alpha. Here's another character. It's only mentioned in flavor text and two cards in beta. And they've been doing that for a long time.
I remember being at a game store not that long ago. I mean, I guess several years ago at this point, and someone was telling me about all this interaction between Tezzeret and Jace, and I was both fascinated that they knew it, or they could have been making the whole thing up.
Those characters do have like a rich back history, yeah.
I'll take your word for it, but I couldn't bite into it. But you know, if we were talking about, you know, the lion and Gilliman or whatever, I'd be like, oh, tell me more.
it is a different thing. I do have like an English degree, and I've got a background in like I was going to be an English teacher and stuff like that. So maybe I've got more of interest in that sort of thing than most. But I can't really put into words or put my finger on why the Horus Heresy novels have resonated with me more than the average Magic novel has. But maybe that will change. I've just picked up some old Magic novels off of eBay that are of an old set, which we're going back to early next year. So I'm going to sort of catch up on the old story and do some videos about it. Maybe I'll fall in love with those old books.
Well, once you get through the first four, and they're written by just world-class author. And I don't mean that because of their New York Times best-selling status or whatever. I mean, these authors are just steeped in this, and you can tell that they care so much about the subject matter, and it comes out through the writing.
And to be fair, I've been listening to the audiobooks as well. I should put that out there whilst painting. So maybe that helps too, right? When you're sat there painting a model, listen to a very, because the first three books especially are incredible, of the Horror Series on Audible. That's probably a bit different to not being engrossed in something else in the hobby and then reading separately, because that it's different, right? It hits different.
I think it's going to be, I want to continue to check in with you if I can, maybe in a few months or so, see where you're at, competitively, see where you're at with the novels.
Check up on me, make sure I'm doing my reading, yeah?
And to make sure that we're at least on book 6 or 7 by then.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, it depends what I'm painting. I'm painting orcs now, so I'm probably going to be looking for orc books.
Oh, The Beast Arises. It's a fabulous set of series set in a really cool period of Warhammer lore.
Is that during the Battle for Armageddon, like the second one?
I don't want to spoil anything for you, but there's like relevance to you, even your sisters and stuff.
Okay, cool. I'll have to check it out because I need a good old book.
Yeah, it gets pretty epic. Well, I mean, I hate to wrap this up, but we're running out of time.
Yeah, no, that's cool. Thank you for having me on, Paul. I appreciate it.
Dude, it's always a pleasure. Hopefully I can check back in with you in a little bit, just because I really, as someone who cares a lot about, both these games that we've talked about, seeing how folks experience it and express themselves through it means a lot to me, and I want to hear as much as I can.
Yeah, definitely. Thanks for having me on.
Dude, have a great rest of your evening.
You're listening to Forge the Narrative.
Hey, everybody, we are back. Hope you enjoyed that segment. It's always great talking to Vince and then people with perspectives, but yet that kind of mindset of wanting to jump in, just full tilt. I love seeing it.
Yeah, me too. It's a lot of enthusiasm. Let's not burn those guys out either. I like to feel that for years to come.
So here
cold, dead inside.
We'll talk about the finishing moves. If you're new around here, we have a hobby segment that we do. We try to do it every week. We have with varying degrees of success of doing it every week. but before we started talking in the pre-show, Adam, you had an interesting topic to jump in about, like maybe how to get started with an airbrush.
Yes, I am. I've been in a really big hobby lull, one of the biggest of my life so far since I started painting. I haven't painted anything since I moved house about almost 4 months ago, and that's kind of the longest I've gone without painting something in kind of the last 5 or 6 years. And so I cracked everything out, got everything ready. I wanted to start painting at night. I had a week off work, got everything set up my hobby station, set up everything, got a table in the garage, perfect, beautiful. And I'm like, yes, so excited to start. And then my airbrush is Cactus, and it is not working. And, I've got masking done, everything's on paddle pop sticks on the night, all the panels are off. I stripped it, got it down to the
that's
the
right, because you were taking an older night with an existing paint job, stripping it down, and we're gonna make it up as in your own wonderful creation color.
Exactly right. And I had like a week off work, and I'm like, beautiful, I've got this awesome paint project I'm gonna reinvigorate. And then my airbrush was Cactus, and I had all these plans to do all these different effects. I want to do some marbling on some shoulder pads and some stripes and things, and I was like, and my bubble just burst. I'm like, wow, a non-starter. I didn't do a single bit of painting over that week off.
An airbrush, I mean, it can be fickle. What I think that means is that even despite your best efforts of diligently cleaning it after every use, you missed something. But you didn't necessarily, maybe you didn't miss something. Maybe you used too much cleaner in there, and then it got gunked up in one of the parts. How the airbrush, look, I'm, please YouTube this, someone, don't take my word for it. but the airbrush is made, for anybody who hasn't used one or is considering it, there are lots of different parts, and it feeds air through some very, very tiny spaces. And then the width of those spaces is typically controlled by a trigger mechanism. It forces air through those tiny spaces, carrying a little bit of paint with it, and then the degree of that paint is controlled by the trigger. If anything along that path of the 4 or 5, I don't know, 1,000 stops it has to make along the way till it finally gets out of the nozzle, gets a little bit of gunk in it, could be a little bit of gunk, restricts some of the air or the material, i.e. the paint, you're boned.
Yep, yep. And it turns out that's what's happened to mine. I have everything required to clean this thing, by the way. I have the little pipe cleaners you get for like flossing your teeth that I stick down there. I've got the alcoholic cleaners. I've got the all different cleaners. I've got a micro vibrator. What is it? Ultrasonic cleaner. I've got all the bits and pieces, all the bells and whistles. Here's the mistake I made. This is the first airbrush I've ever owned, and I went above and beyond and got a really high quality one. Big mistake. Do not buy a Porsche on your first car. With lots
of intricate parts.
Exactly right. Do not get a Porsche for your first car. Get that Toyota Camry we were talking about like, about half an hour ago. And this is what I've come to now, because like, so my, the stuff I do with airbrushes is pretty basic. And most of it, I do still and really enjoy like panel lining and recess shading with a brush. I still enjoy having a brush in my hand. So my airbrushing has stayed maintained pretty basic. Base coats, some special effects like marbling, which I do with either steel wool or a baby wipe. You know, you pull out the filaments and stuff. And so it's really pretty basic. You know, some masking, some stripes, some things like that. And I didn't need to go above and beyond and get an expensive. I won't tell you the model because I don't want to put anybody off for buying these very good quality airbrushes. But I went above and beyond and bought an expensive, you know, top of the line airbrush. And I just wasn't up to the task of maintaining it, it turns out. It has done me about a year, 18 months I've owned this guy, and I've painted a huge amount of models through it, and I've thought I've maintained it pretty well. It turns out I haven't. So it's
probably salvageable. Like this is something that is, you can remedy it.
Yeah, look, so I've cleaned it in every possible way I know how to clean it. I've checked to see if the needle is bent or blunt. It's not. I've checked all the components individually. And I think it's just beyond my expertise. And unfortunately, I'm in lockdown at the moment, so I don't have the ability to take it to one of my mates who probably knows better and probably just ding me over the back of the head and say, you did this wrong. Don't do this next time.
We're going to walk through this in video conference. I want to try to be here for you after the show.
We're going to get red on. He's going to blindfold me. I'm going to have to take my airbrush apart and put it together. Been around 3 times, top of 1 foot. Yeah. But yeah, so this is, and I know, Paul airbrushes, Tanya doesn't. And I'm quite new to it, prospectively. It took me a while to pull the trigger on it as well. I wasn't convinced about it. It was a Freudian pun. And I didn't pull the trigger on it because I was afraid that I wouldn't enjoy it and that it would take something away from my hobby rather than bring the enjoyment of the brush and the satisfaction of it. And I just found it to be, I don't know if you feel the same way, Paul, but it just became another tool in the toolbox and enabled me to do a lot of things that I'd seen other people do that I'd always wanted to.
Yes. So with an airbrush for me, I do not have the finer skill of capture of doing too much detail work. Like what I can do is get a solid base coat on and probably that first layer of highlights. And highlights, I can get a little bit of that brightness and maybe a little bit of transition. And maybe if I haven't completely covered up my depreciated tint that I did, you'll see some transition in the airbrush.
Love it.
It saves. It's a time saver. I think any of these things that you can work into your routine as potentially a time saver. And when you're doing, let's say, you know, you paint a lot of red miniatures.
I wouldn't know anybody who does that though.
Maybe Mephiston red?
Yeah.
Nah, no one does that. No one. Definitely no one I know.
Maybe you figured out a really good recipe and you've also figured out how to make the airbrush work for that second stage of red, that brighter red in your color scheme. And you have the habit of painting 4 vehicles or 30 troops at a time or whatever.
Yeah. Chasing certain metas or, you know.
Or you're getting started with gray knights and you want to lay down a couple of metallics. An airbrush is a great tool because that may save you some time. You can then, it ramps you up to being able, like, and I really suggest any of that time that you save with an airbrush, you spend in the details, like the painting extra bits, painting cool shoulder pad details, painting the cases on your bolter, going the extra mile on the purity seals, like invest that time in back into the cooler parts of the miniature, maybe. Big suggestion there. But the airbrush is not just take it out of the box and instant talent. It's not the devil in mud of... you know, of army tools.
Man, do you even know what Devlin Mud is, Tanya?
I do, actually. I have a case of vintage paints.
Love it. Oh my goodness. Do you have old goblin?
I do, actually. In like the old like hexagon pot with like the white sort of cap lid on it. I got those ones.
Man, I still love those. They're legit.
They still work, okay? Like those paints with the hexagon bottle. Oh man, they're still good. They work perfect to this day.
That's the back in my day, things were going to come up.
Eternal warriors. But with an airbrush, you have to, you need to get familiar with how to take it apart. And also, which in and of itself can be intimidating, because once that spring comes out, once that trigger, when you realize the trigger comes completely off of it and you're sitting there holding two pieces or more of this thing you just spent over $100 on, it can be, you know, it's soul searing.
It's a good way. Yeah. Good way of describing it.
So I don't want to like even remotely suggest that people just go out and dive into an airbrush. But if you figure out there, if you get over that hump, get into that learning curve part of it and learn to basically take it apart and put it back together again and oil it in the right way. Cause that's another thing, you know, you've got to get a little oil in there. I'm sure this already sounds the sweltering to people. Some people listening right now.
I'm not gonna lie, yeah. Sounds like a hard pass to me.
Yeah, well, I was interested to talk to Tanya. Like, you've never been interested in airbrushing? You don't think it's something for you?
So I actually did try airbrushing back when I first started, and I played Chaos Space Marines way back in like 2013 or something like that. And I work at a pawn shop, and just like a cheap airbrush came through. Obviously I have tools. So like I had a tiny, like little compressor. I just got like a moisture sort of trap for it and all this stuff and set it up and tried it. And I've never been so frustrated in my life. And I like wasted a day trying to figure this thing out, take it apart, put it back together, like trying to get the paint consistency right. Because also in that time, I didn't have anybody in my town that like sold airbrush paints. Mm-hmm. So I had no idea like what consistency I was going for, anything like that. And I just, after the day, I just set it down. And I was like, this is not for me. Like, my hobby is not supposed to be this frustrating. So I'm just going to go back to my like 25-cent brushes. And yeah, I've never been tempted from that day forward.
I think a lot of people out there can relate to that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it might just be because like I got a cheap secondhand one, right? So I don't know how the person who had it before me took care of it or anything like that. But yeah, it just was. Yeah. And I'm not like a techie, like technologically adept kind of tinkerer person, right? Like, so.
The first airbrush I ever had was given to me by someone who, it was a cheap airbrush, and they just said, here you go, take my old airbrush. And it, I think I spilt more paint out of blowback out of it than I actually got out of it. It was so miserable. Good. And it wasn't until I called one of my buddies who is, I mean, in my opinion, GMM is probably the greatest army commission painter out there.
Nice. That's a huge indictment.
Yeah. I mean, like full on concept army, his displays are jaw-droppingly epic, you know, just for talking about for full complete armies. And I mean, like probably three or four armies in one. Yeah. Like look at his stuff. It speaks for itself. But he, I know, had been using an airbrush a lot at that point in time. And this was a long time ago. This was 7-8 years ago. And I was like, yo, help me. He's like, well, have you tried cleaning it? And it sounds basic, especially after what I just told you. But can you guess what my answer was? Well, no. I mean, well, of course I have. I've run water through it or whatever. But there's really all these, there's just kind of fiddly and finicky parts inside of it that I think once you just kind of learn where they are and learn what to do and how to be somewhat diligent about your cleanup process. Like you can't just, you know, flick the brush off in a water cup and put your brush down. You've got to add a little bit of extra time to your routine. And I mean, not everybody can do that.
I will admit, like, I have no patience for like cleanup or anything like that. Like people have been trying to get me to like make the switch to oil paints. And I'm like, nah, it takes forever to dry. And like, I need like mineral spirits and stuff. Nah, it's okay.
You got to have different brushes too. That's another thing. Right. You're really not supposed to use your same brushes for the oils and then acrylics.
Like on top of that, I don't like doing brush care. So like I don't like I own Sable brushes. I never use them because I don't want to have to like get the soap out and condition them and like all this stuff. Like I use cheap acrylic brushes and away I go. So but it's
they're dead.
I paid 25 cents for them. I actually donate them to a ceramics teacher, so she, because ceramics are really hard on brushes, so
yes,
so yeah, I donate them to her, and then she uses them till they're really dead. And yeah, it's that's just my whole ethos. Like, I would just rather be spending more time painting. And I also feel like I haven't mastered acrylics and the brush yet. So, like, I don't feel like I'm ready to, like, branch out. No,
you're pretty darn good. I mean,
you're far too kind.
No, it's good stuff. I mean, but, well, yeah, I know it's taking this off the point, but it is great. People check out your Instagram and see some of your miniatures and all battle reports and stuff. It's awesome. But if I had to give some advice on what to get for an airbrush, I would not start with the top of the line for a couple of reasons. Reason one is everything we just described. Reason two is if you haven't done it before, you don't know it's for you to like Tanya's point. And
like when you said it's $100, you're probably $100 for the airbrush. You still got to buy the compressor. You got to buy all the cleaning implements and stuff. You still got to buy usually either a bucket of thinner if you don't buy actual thinned paints, or you know a whole new range of paints just for airbrushing. It's not an easy commitment.
Yeah, and to have something that could easily turn into, once you've gotten everything, a 200 USD or more paperweight.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I suggest just going and trying a mate's. Like if you don't know anybody who has one, look up some tutorials, see why people like and dislike them. There's plenty of amazing artists out there. I mean, one of the great people, I mean, Duncan Rhodes, yeah. I've never seen him use an airbrush. In not a single tutorial has he ever used one. And yet, and there's a group of guys, artists that I follow called Cult of Paint. And they're like, you know, they intersect an airbrush in to do, you know, base coating, the easy stuff. And then they'll switch to a brush, back to an airbrush, and whatever's going to get them the result that they want. And I suppose it's just horses for courses. It's really just where you're at.
Well, so if you're going to get one, well, figure out what your budget is, you know, and then get one that's probably a little bit under your budget. But when you're doing your budgeting, factor in the whole thing. You're also going to need a compressor. And there's a lot of discount tool places out there will sell compressor. They'll also have airbrush suitable compressors, but not every compressor is airbrush suitable. You've got to figure out, do a little bit of research, find out which are and which are not. You don't want to get like one of those giant compressors from Home Depot, even if it's on sale, because it just will not work for your airbrush. You got to find one that's is. And so you can find a good one somewhere between $50 to $80. But then again, I said, that's $50 to $80. That's a squad of Terminators. You're trading off here, you know, with things.
Just a tip, like if people do want to try it and don't want to go out and buy a really expensive one, sometimes you can go online to different like food service sort of providers. And because you wouldn't think this, but you can actually get cheap airbrushes there because cake decorators use them.
Mm-hmm. That's a pro tip.
So you can get them for like a fraction of the cost. They're not exactly like top of the line, but it would probably be relatively cheap, like less than $50. And you could get a good idea if it was something that you were going to like or not.
Yeah, I think that's just like you're talking about when upgrading things, when you are at that comfortability, at that skill level, you figure out it is for you, or you find that the tool is limiting your capacity. And that's not always the case. Sometimes just your capacity or your current understanding of the skill level is limiting your capacity. So I would wait until you're absolutely sure that you're ready to upgrade to a more expensive brush with a finer nozzle or whatever. Yeah, there's some out there that have guards, you know, you can lock in the distance that your trigger will fire. I mean, there's fancy things out there. You don't necessarily need all those widgets. If you're just getting into it, you've got to figure out, how do I get paint from the reserve to the miniature? And then how to clean these things, how to be disciplined with the cleaning on these things, which I think we, at least Adam and I, have a horror story of not being diligent with cleaning and spending more time fighting with it instead of painting with it.
Well, yeah, that was especially like the first month of using it. I was like, wow, I've just wasted my money. And it took me ages and lots of phone calls from my mates who were amazingly patient with me, because I'm not good at some of these things at the best of times. And yeah, I actually went to my mate's place a couple of times, and he just showed me a lot of things, taught me a bit of appreciating as well, which I found was really a really interesting thing. It's like reverse painting your highlights on the miniatures. And that's a really interesting skill set if you want to get into it. And one thing I found really interesting about airbrushes, chances are there's a local airbrush maker in your country, because they're actually, or in your continent, there's European airbrush makers, there's Japanese ones, there's American, a Badger in America, very high quality airbrushes. If you want to buy it local, chances are you can, which I think is also a pretty cool thing.
Yeah, nice. This is something to put in your hobby toolbox if you want to do it. And it doesn't necessarily have to be for large scale projects. I've found that it is a time saver for me when I'm putting down that first and second layer of paint. And then I can't do it. Then I've got to switch back to the regular brush.
So my current army at the moment, seeing as I'm not painting this night anymore, my current army has been this 30K-esque Dark Angels army. I've been doing this army for about 2 years. So I probably had an airbrush about 2 years, because I started this with it because I wanted to do I've got a green tinge on the black. I've got a bit of P3 cold black, which is like a green black, and I use that to tinge it to make them look, give us that, to evoke, you know, Dark Angels, even though they're a black, silver, and red, like the 30K Dark Angels are. And I simply did that because that was like my practice thing. I want to get good at getting a good highlight from a directional highlight with an airbrush. I was like, we do a whole army on this, and then I'm going to do a nice crisp stripe, red stripe on all their shins and all their helmets. And, you know, on bigger models, I do that with an airbrush, and I'm just going to learn some basics, and I found it extremely satisfying. Like, is there anything more satisfying than when you airbrush a stripe and then peel the tape off and just it's perfect? You're just like, oh,
I have a friend who does like Instagram videos of him removing the masking after his painting, and I'm just like, this is so visually satisfying
That's nice. I do not often get it right. I normally have to do touch-ups even after a mask, and I try to. I don't know if it's the humidity in Georgia, or I don't let the paints fully cure one way or another or something, or I let them cure too much. I have yet to figure out how to always get that perfect pull.
Yeah, it's. I went to my local hardware store and I found painter's tape, like actual tape, masking tape used by painters and decorators. And I started using that. And I found that was a big step up from just using regular old masking tape, especially because you can really control the amount of tack, the amount of, you know, stickiness or adhesion they have. And so you can get really low tack ones that won't damage any other coats you've done that you're putting the sticky tape over.
Very nice. I want to hear some of people's, I was going to say just horror stories, but no, the successes were the airbrush as well. It can be daunting, and I hope we haven't turned anybody off from doing it. I think it's better almost if you know what to expect when you're getting into it. So you kind of have a better sense of maybe some of the trappings you have to get successful with to make it do what
you
want
early
on.
I would like people to either in the comments or, you know, through a message or whatever, sell me on it.
There you go. Like,
sell me on it. Like, I've had a bad experience, you know, but maybe somebody out there has like the motivation to make me want to get up and try it again.
Well, that's it, folks. Yeah, thanks for joining us. Led the variety we've had on this show. And then next week, hopefully Red's back with us, and we'll be talking mm-hmm. more about taking a stand and the consequences of those decisions.
Yeah, part two of the culture crafting. Can't wait.
We'll see you.
They said, but I already subscribed. You better do it too.